Hello and welcome to this week's program. I'm Paul Nelson. One of the most inventive writers in the Puget Sound region is our guest today. John Olson, like other good writers, helps us pay attention to things we might not otherwise notice.
What a peculiar creature, like a Martian in miniature, long, brittle legs, two fat claws, and a pair of antennas shooting out of its mouth or head. Or whatever that cluster of apparatus is at the front of its body. Who could eat such a creature? Who could eat a lobster? Lots of people eat lobster. Lobster is considered a delicacy. Think about it. Lobster is considered a delicacy. Why are delicacies always so weird? Eyeballs, monkey brains, testicles.
John also believes it is important to value art and have an appreciation for aesthetics in general in order to preserve what little civilization is left in this world.
When these values begin to deteriorate, we're not that far away from having another Bosnia or Rwanda or some other horrible thing like that. Because it's language, it's values. The values that we share with one another, our cultural values, these are the things that hold us together as a people.
Our chat with poet John Olson is our feature today as we chat about the weirdness of delicacies and the importance of writing and art to society. I hope you enjoy today's program. Thanks for tuning in. It Plays in Peoria Productions wants to thank everyone who made Diane DePrima's reading and workshop at the SPLAB a roaring success, including the King County Arts Commission, the Washington State Commission for the Humanities, the Auburn Arts Commission, the Institute for Community Leadership, and all of our co-sponsors. Thank you. Coming up next year, it's the third annual Super Bowl of Poetry featuring Sharon Dubiago, Robin Schultz, Nico Vasilakis, and Jack and Adele Foley of Oakland, California. There will be workshops on Super Bowl Saturday, the 29th, and on Super Bowl Sunday, the 30th, there will be a reading with all five poets and maybe one surprise poet. That's January 29th and 30th, 2000. We're also starting to do live tapings of this radio show at the SPLAB. More information is on the web at www.inpeoria.org. That's INPEORIA.org and SPLAB.org. Or call for regular updates at 253-735-MEET, 253-735-6328. And after our holiday break, 19th Draft will continue the regular Thursday night Writers' Critique Circle known as Living Room. Every Thursday night starting at 7, happening February 3rd, 2000, and every Thursday thereafter. Bring your new work and get gentle critiques from other writers at the SPLAB. The Northwest Spoken Word Lab, another village building project of It Plays in Peoria Productions. For more on the guests of this show, the titles of their books or names of their organizations, for links to their websites or for other times and places to hear these programs, check out the website for It Plays in Peoria Productions at www.inpeoria.org. That's INPEORIA.org. Once there, you'll find current show summaries, contact information, and even summaries of past programs for the purpose of ordering tapes. You can also find a link to the SPLAB, the Northwest Spoken Word Lab, an intergenerational spoken word performance, resource, and outreach center, a project under the nonprofit umbrella of It Plays in Peoria. The SPLAB is where the holistic concepts discussed on this show are implemented in a community setting. So check out what we're up to at www.inpeoria.org. Just like the town in Illinois, that's INPEORIA.org. Another village building project of It Plays in Peoria Productions. Many writers have their niche down. It may be humor, or it might be a sense of wordplay. It might be elegant, or it may have a very abstract sense. It might be witty at the expense of depth or subtext. Combine all these positive attributes and you get a sense of the work of one local poet. John Olson is the author of Eggs and Mirrors from Woodworks Press, Swarm of Edges from BCC Press, and Logo Lagoon from Paper Brain Press in San Diego. His poetry has been published in numerous journals, including Talisman, Sulphur, New American Writing, The Raven Chronicles, and The Germ. His criticism has been in the American Book Review and The Stranger, and his short stories have appeared in Etc., Dirigible, and First Intensity. He's also written two feature stories for the Seattle Weekly and is currently preparing to teach a class in writing the prose poem for the UW Extension program in the spring. It's our pleasure to welcome to the program John Olson. Howdy.
Hi, Paul.
Nice to have you here in Auburn.
Oh, thank you. I enjoy being here.
Yeah, well, see if you can say that after the interview. No, it'll be fine. You know, we just got through with Diane DePrima. In fact, we sent her off this morning. And one of the interesting things in the chronology of her life that she has in the back of her new collected poems is she made a commitment to poetry at the age of 14. Did you have a similar sense at an early age that you were going to have a life of writing ahead of you?
Yes. In fact, it happened rather suddenly. It happened in the back of a friend's Plymouth. He had a 55 Plymouth, and we were on our way to a junkyard. I think we were looking for an alternator, or maybe it was a carburetor. I can't remember what piece of equipment we were looking for. But it was a gloomy day, like today, gray, somber, albeit it was August. And he had speakers in the back of his car, in the back of the Plymouth. And I think we had just been listening to This Diamond Ring by, I think his name was Gary Lewis, Jerry Lewis's son.
Oh, really? Yeah, and, Gary Lewis and the Playboys, wasn't it?
Yeah, right. And the next thing we heard was Bob Dylan kicking in with Like a Rolling Stone. And I was astonished. I had never heard anything that amazing before, either musically or verbally. I had never heard words put together quite like that before, and it grabbed me. I was hooked. And the next day I went to the library and started looking for some poetry because I wanted to do something similar to what Bob Dylan was doing with words in creating those marvelous, phantasmagoric images.
Yeah, it's very interesting. What part of the country was this in?
This is Seattle. Somewhere over in Seattle, I think, in what is now Martin Luther King Drive.
So you grew up here?
Actually, I was born in Minnesota, and my parents moved out to Seattle when I was about 12.
I see. Now, it's interesting you say that, because when we had Allen Ginsberg on the show, 1994, and he talked about Dylan and how much Dylan was influenced by Kerouac and Mexico City Blues, and when he read that, it was the first poetry that was talking to him in his own language. And so, obviously, you hear the beats filtered once through Dylan and coming back and influencing you. That's very interesting.
Well, yeah, except for that particular stage that Dylan was into, he had segued out of this Woody Guthrie influence in the folk songs he was doing, which were pretty grassroots and pretty accessible and basic. And what he was doing with Highway 61 and Bringing It All Back Home was much more surrealistic. And that was the phase of Dylan's career that really grabbed me, was that intensely surrealistic stage, which put me in the direction of the French surrealist poets, Breton and Tristan Tzara and Guillaume Apollinaire. And eventually I got hooked on Gertrude Stein. And that's been almost a lifetime passion, is reading Gertrude Stein.
That's interesting, because my next question was about the influences. Dada's another influence.
Big one. Dada's big. Dada's a huge influence on me.
So you're like 15 years old going to the library and getting Apollinaire and these poets?
No, I was about 18 when this occurred. In fact, I was just right out of high school. And my time in high school was, mediocre at best. I didn't have any real passion for anything in high school. I enjoyed painting. I think art was my favorite class. But it wasn't until that summer, right after I graduated and I heard that song by Bob Dylan, that I suddenly became intensely passionate about something, in this case, poetry in particular. Actually, the first poet apart from Bob Dylan that really put me on fire was Rimbaud. And a friend in San Jose, California, showed me Le Bateau Ivre, a drunken boat by Rimbaud, and I could not believe it. My eyes were popping out of my head. I just couldn't believe that anybody could write something that fantastic. something with so much fiery, phantasmagoric imagery, and something that just carried you away into this other world. It was and it had so much power.
Yeah, it's like the difference between Gary Lewis and the Playboys and Bob Dylan. It's sort of like a black and white, or from going from black and white to this intensely colored sort of experience, to use a metaphor. You know, I mean, just an incredible juxtaposition, I guess, is one word to put it.
Yeah, you could say that. With me, the poetry at this particular time, we're talking, this is going to date me incredibly, but we're talking 1965, 1966. So poetry was blended in with the rock and roll at that particular time, too. And so it had a very intense subversive quality as well, which was very attractive. When you're 18 years old, anything that's subversive is going to be inherently attractive. And so that's poets like Robert Frost and Carl Sandburg, although they interested me, did not have that subversive fire that Rambo offered. There was a lot of attitude in Rambo's work, a whole lot of attitude there.
Yeah. And Sandburg really lost that after he gained a certain. I read a biography on Sandburg about the. What was it? The hidden Carl Sandburg or something, and his strong socialist leanings, and then he got to a certain point where he became popular and kind of left that behind and changed. And really, his best work is probably before that. I forget the name of the book, and I'm doing it a disservice, but it was really, really well done. I would like to get you to read something. So let me restate who we're talking to. We're talking to John Olson, Seattle poet and author of Eggs and Mirrors and Logo Lagoon, among other new publications. Logo Lagoon, published by Paper Brain Press in San Diego. And the only reason I say that is because I like the way my mouth feels when I say Paper Brain Press. It's nice to say. I'm Paul Nelson. I think it's really important for anyone listening to get a sense of your sharp wit and sense of wordplay to actually hear something so they know what we're talking about when we talk about that wit that I've related to. And, you know, I guess we can all relate to eating, so there's something at the beginning, I think, of Eggs and Mirrors about eating.
There's a lot of food in Eggs and Mirrors.
Yes, there
well, a lot of food. There.
Hence the eggs reference. I had a mark here for something later, so let's just kind of make a note of that. With right there, but let me just kind of pass this on to you. And this is a beautiful book, by the way, Woodworks Press. Paul Hunter doing this hand press still.
Yeah, they call it hot type. I love that phrase, hot type. When you set type by hand, it's an incredibly laborious process. But
and he cranks them out. He literally to hold that wheel. That
I'm amazed. I'm astonished at the quantity of material that he puts out because it's so painstaking. You have to spend so much meticulous focus on what you're doing, but he's really. I paid a visit to his house, and he does all this in his basement with his this giant press from 1904, Treadle press from 1904, behemoth of a thing. It's very formidable looking apparatus to look at. It kind of reminds me of the Rube Gold, one of those intricate, bizarre Rube Goldberg apparatuses. Compelling thing to look at. And he's down there in his basement with classical music playing, violin concerto by Bartok or somebody. And it's really peaceful. You get a really peaceful feeling when you're down there. And he does woodcuts too, which is amazing. In fact, I couldn't believe the design Paul did for this thing. How would you describe this to people? It's an egg on a tricycle. An egg on a tricycle. And the first time he showed it to me, I thought, that's it. He's captured the spirit of my writing with this egg on a tricycle. That's it.
He's quite a craftsman himself. And not to mention a wonderful poet who's been on the show a couple of times.
Oh, yeah. He's a beautiful poet. There's a real rawness and immediacy to his writing. It's really, really compelling. I like Paul's writing a great deal. Did you want me to read?
Yeah, I think the lobster thing, the first piece.
Today's Menu.
Is that what it is?
Today's Menu. Okay. Today's Menu. The astonishing reality of a lobster is compelling, n'est-ce pas? Like the silhouette of a murder or a car turning its headlights on and off. What a peculiar creature, like a Martian in miniature, long, brittle legs, two fat claws, and a pair of antennas shooting out of its mouth or head. Or whatever that cluster of apparatus is at the front of its body. Who could eat such a creature? Who could eat a lobster? Lots of people eat lobster. Lobster is considered a delicacy. Think about it. Lobster is considered a delicacy. Why are delicacies always so weird? Eyeballs, monkey brains, testicles, delicacies. And what about eating? Eating is inherently strange. What could be more odd than putting something in your mouth and chewing it into a malleable pulp and swallowing it, inviting it to become a member of your body, its community of cells? A chicken wing, say. What was once the muscle and sinew of a chicken wing chewed, swallowed, metabolized, and turned into a trapezoid or bicep, a passing thought or an enzyme, a protein or a wet dream. So what do you say, let's eat? Yes, yes, let's eat. I'm hungry. Let's sip the infinity of night, gulp the stars, chew daylight, savor twilight, tenderize dawn, mull the evening, swallow swallows, masticate, abdicate, and stuff ourselves with anything that moves, anything that waddles, wiggles, swims, or flies. Blossoms, burgeons, bulges or blooms, clams, cloves, coconut, beef, bacon, broth, bread, pork chops, omelets, peaches, peas, potatoes, prawns, pralines, poultry, salads, waffles, sauces, soups, crepe Suzette and Chateaubriand, Portuguese cream soup and roast saddle of veal, epigrams of lamb and chicken sauté with artichokes, chicken, duck, goose, turkey, pigeon, and squab, hamburgers galore, hot dogs, hot dogs, hot dogs, eyeballs, testicles, brains, sauce lyonnaise, sauce mayonnaise, sauce polonaise, and lobster. Lots and lots of lobster.
Oh, there's so many things to talk about. First of all, the fact that lobster is basically a giant insect, a sea insect. Isn't that right?
Yes, yes. I think it's in that family.
Yeah. Which maybe we ought to be eating more insects. I don't know. But the other thing is that when you read it aloud, and when I hear you reading aloud or heard it or hear it read aloud, it's this sense of this tremendous joy that comes out of just this, of just reading it, just getting a kick out of reading what you've put together. And you don't get that from everyone. You know, I guess you get that from the best writers, but this intense joy and playfulness that comes out when you read that.
Yeah, I love language. I love language. It's I love everything about language. I'm constantly absolutely mystified, spellbound by the wonderful capacity we have to both share our thoughts and our feelings, our experiences, but also to have this marvelous instrument that's capable of so much richness of meaning at the same time. A medium that, unlike other mediums like clay or paint, is more like music in many ways, in that you can approach an abstractness with it without losing the concrete, without losing the world of sensation, and which is another dimension to language that I really like, is the fact that you can generate sensation. You can arrive at meanings and sensations that you did not necessarily intend at the very beginning. So that language becomes like almost like an ocean. It's like a fluid medium that you can plunge into and allow it to take you to places that you hadn't really even expected to go.
Well, let's talk about that, because that comes out of process. And, you know, many people already know how the poem's going to end when they start writing it. And I'm the kind of person, and I think it goes along with the beat influence and the open verse revolution of this century, of kind of letting the poem write itself. You know, God writes the poem with my pen or something like that, as I'm paraphrasing what Diane DePriem was talking about this past weekend. Tell us about your process, how you like to write. You like to sit down at a certain time, you've got to study, and tell us all about the editing, if any.
I write nearly constantly. I always carry a notebook with me wherever I go. In fact, it was just when I was eating my Danish and drinking coffee at the restaurant across the street. Over there, I was jotting some notes down. With me, writing is very compulsive. It helps me to see things more clearly. It's just like if you were to sit down with a pencil and draw a table or a chair or a plant, you begin to see it differently. You begin to see it much more acutely, and you notice things that you hadn't noticed before. It's the same with writing. That's one reason. But I also use a whole raft of strategies to get the words out down on paper. There's nothing more terrifying or intimidating than a blank sheet of paper. And you can freeze up instantly because there's this very deep grained feeling or idea that when you write that there's something very inherently formal about that. And so you consequently, whatever you put on paper must resonate with a great amount of intelligence. And I really feel all that intelligence. So it's nice just to be able to relax, to feel comfortable with the writing process. So it's nice to have some words on hand, i.e. a dictionary. That's a good source. You can just go to a dictionary and start choosing words at random. You can do what Tristan Tzara did. You can find a magazine article, something in National Geographic or some other newspaper or whatever, brochure for the Washington State Ferries. It can be anything. Is a voter pamphlet, one of those things, anything at all, and cut the words out, put them in a paper bag, shake them all up in the bag, and then one by one take the words out of the bag and faithfully write them down as they come out of the bag, and you will be the author or authoress of a Dada poem. There's William Burroughs' cutouts and his fold-in techniques. I like to do that quite frequently, where you take a paragraph and slice it down the middle and take one half of that paragraph and join it to the half of yet another paragraph. And that's another way to generate meaning. I've done this with a lot of people, and I've noticed, too, with a lot of people that in workshop situations, writing workshop situations, that people sometimes resist that because they feel that if they're using these tricks and strategies to write, that somehow it's, even though the results might be marvelous, they don't feel like it's coming from them, and which I feel is really kind of silly, because language, unless you can assume responsibility for inventing the language yourself, language itself is something that's already there.
Which Tristan Tzara can take credit for inventing a language himself. Some of the sound
poems.
That's true.
Some of the sound poems he did, which I'm unfortunately not quite as inventive as he was when it comes to, except when I'm privately at home, I might start bubbling, spewing very weird sounds.
I see.
But it's nothing I would want to do in public.
Or you might be bubbling and spewing weird sounds after eating a Danish, but that'd be a different...
That would be my stomach.
Oh, is that what that is?
Yeah, that would be my stomach doing those kind of things.
Okay. But the notion of chance creating more meaning than you could yourself, I think, is a notion that... you know, crushes the ego, and that's what I'm after. And yet, the average writer is not it. Mm-hmm. You know, when you go to the average open mic or you pick up the average anthology and book of poetry, it's see how clever I am and what I came up with, where the beats we're talking about, and the surrealists and the Dadaists, how by chance processes mm-hmm. you can come up with stuff that you would never have thought of that are much more beautiful and indicate that you're a tiny thing compared to what's really writing the poem.
Yeah, there is that. If you can think of language, if you can think of your perceptions and thoughts as being language-driven, in other words, I've tried this experiment many times before, tried thinking without language. It's impossible to do. I mean, that is how heavily imbued we are with language, which is my fascination with language, but also it says a lot about who we are, who our identity is. Our identities are largely the product of the social valuations that we find in the language that we're using. And so it's really in many ways hard to distinguish between what is an honest, raw, open emotion coming from me and how much of that is actually the language that I'm using and the social valuation that's inherent in that language. Mm-hmm. But this is a conflict I myself share with people, because there's a large part of me that would also like to just shout make sounds that a la Tristan Tzara that emanate completely from the depth of my being, as it were, as opposed to using this other medium where I get twisted or distorted, and something else takes over. Yeah. It's an ongoing conflict.
Yeah. The one other question that came out of the process is writer's block, and it would seem to me that that's not a problem for you.
No, it's not, because the language is always there. If I get stuck, I can just
Try something else.
I can try something else, or I can call somebody up and have a conversation, and that's a good way to start generating some ideas, or I can just start writing words down randomly out of a dictionary. So it's never really a problem. As long as language exists, I have this medium that I can involve myself with it. It's never really a problem. Plus, I'm always observing things. I'm always noticing things. It's impossible not to notice things, and to want to write down what I see.
That's very interesting. So there's a new sort of realization for me that the folks who talk, because writer's block is not, there might be stretches of time where I don't write, or I don't write poetry necessarily, but I might be journaling, I might be writing introductions to my interviews, I'm always doing some kind of writing, but it seems to me that writer's block comes from that notion of, the person with the ego thinking they have to create it, they have to craft it.
Oh, sure, that you have to be intelligent, you have to be perceptive. There's always that inner critic that is real hard to get rid of. That inner voice telling you that, oh, what you just wrote, that's ridiculous, that's silly, that's stupid, that's dumb. That ongoing inner critic is hard to purge from your system. One easy way to do it for me has been to keep a journal, because as long as I give myself permission in a journal format to be as stupid as I want, I'm never really in trouble. I don't. As long as the onus is not on me to be intelligent and sharp and perceptive, and I have this marvelous permission to be as goofy or silly or whatever as I want, it's not a problem.
Well, the silliness will have to continue in our next interview. So we're going to break off right here, but you have time to stick around, don't you?
Oh, sure.
Very good. John Olson is our guest. He's the author of Eggs and Mirrors from Woodworks Press in Seattle, as well as Logo Lagoon from Paper Brain Press in San Diego. We're chatting with John Olson. He's a Seattle poet and author, and more to come. If you'd like more information, you can check out our website at inpeoria.org. That's inpeoria.org, and we'll have some contact information for John on the website.